that it had, in essence, particularly for local policy actors, it has limited application in policy area. And this is Edgar Morin's concept of restricted complexity. The idea being that basically, in essence, we were trying to avoid that because our sense was, you know, modeling has certain places certainly applicable in certain areas, but to your core, you know, in essence, your frontline staff, they're not dealing with models. They're dealing with basic inputs, you know, strategies, policies, et cetera. So again, it was about trying to say, on a grand scale, which was a difficult thing to match because we were trying to sort of say, look, this applies to any policy, but then we had to drop it down into certain policy areas and walk through those areas. The current situation as we saw it, many elite and non-elite policy actors are aware that they deal with complex issues. You know, complexity is there, it's all around. Again, the C word might not be mentioned, but it's really obvious. References to these types of strategies are throughout their reports without much knowledge of why or how. In other words, they know they're constantly, you know, you can talk to any local actor, talk to a school teacher, talk to a nurse, talk to a social worker. They know their problems are complex, you know, they've got it. But in essence, there isn't a framework surrounding them. They can't come to grips with that. And oftentimes, they're trapped within a much more, you know, as hopefully everybody knew, much more linear, much more orderly structured framework that constantly, you know, sort of pins them in. So things like stakeholder engagement being important, innovation often happens at frontline, end state planning, not advised in some cases, you know, in many cases, and direction of travel is much more useful in such cases. In other words, when you're dealing with these complex issues, why we're off the screen here, but. In essence, it was about learning some of these basic tactics. In essence, for us, we kept sort of thinking as we were going through it, how can we write a book on something so immense as complexity that a nurse, a teacher, a social worker be at least be able to grasp, get clearly and coherently? And so we wanted to simplify and demystify it, create a bridge between complexity specialists, public policy practitioners, assure the decision makers at elite and non-elite levels they're already using the concepts. It's already there. In essence, we want to say, look, you're already experts at complexity. You know, it's actually nothing new. Many of these things are the things you're dealing with constantly. And some of your core problems are because you're desperately trying to wedge what are complex problems into orderly boxes or linear responses. And literally, you know, you're already, you know, in essence, we wanted to sort of get this guy's look, you're already experts in complexity. And we wanted to stress that not all situations are wholly complex or wholly orderly. Many situations cover a whole range of behaviors, and we can get into the discussion over how this is and a way to sort of talk about that. But these were sort of the kind of core things we were trying to get across. The structure of the book was intentional, a general introduction that walks through, in essence, we decided to go, starting at its most basic, looking at, if you like, complexity and how it emerges out of the physical sciences, to the biological sciences, to the social sciences, because there has been sort of a historical spillover, if you look at the 20th century, of a movement in that direction, where you have sort of coming out of your early sort of physics and maths, moving into your sort of biological, evolutionary thinking, and then towards the social sciences, where it begins to spill over into the social sciences, at least as a term of sort of an academic term, 1980s, 90s, and into the 2000s. And we said, right, let's pick some of the core concepts which we think are really useful. And so we had concepts that came out of each of those fields, and we had six tools that we just sort of said, okay, well, what are the core tools that you can just apply? And we thought, right, we were arguing that all of these tools can apply to any policy area, but we picked one per policy area, and then we just picked different policy areas to apply them in. So health was one. We were looking at general areas, so there was a general area of politics, international relations, we had development. And then because of terrorism was such a big topic, we thought, right, we'll put in a chapter on sort of terrorism and one on the case of Iraq. And in the case of Iraq, we tried to sort of pull back from, if you like, a more an emotional approach to it, to look at Iraq as fundamentally a monstrous planning disaster, because fundamentally it's a tremendously, you know, apply $1 trillion and hope it goes in a certain direction. Apply $1 trillion and it goes in such a disastrous direction that you're leaving yourself with this monstrous legacy. Well, how could, looked at from a traditional social science framework where you're applying rational inputs to reasonable policy tactics and reasonable outcomes should occur, this linear outcome, in a sense, was hoped, planned, and utilized. How on earth could extremely bright people, these were, despite George Bush being at the top of it, a whole range of incredibly bright people, hard educated, these were bright minds, tremendous funding, are going to bungle up this thing so enormously? So in essence, we try to say our core argument was that fundamentally they viewed it as a linear, and there's politics around that and why. But the core politics was they viewed it as a linear outcome. Apply force, apply money, direct outcomes, appropriate inputs in terms of leaders, appropriate intelligent leaders, boom, the things should just go. I'm just finishing a lovely book by Rory Stewart, who was governor of a province around the marsh area in southern Iraq, and his description of the daily events of him trying to sort of coordinate all these different groups. The groups are here, they're backed by, there's Iranian-backed groups, there's competing religious groups, and he's just sitting there struggling, it's like playing chess on multiple boards where all the pieces are changing every day. Well, how on earth could he possibly do, and you could see he's desperately trying, but it's just overwhelming. It's a fascinating thing of saying, well, this is why there was no way, it was just going to be sheer luck if somehow that policy managed to work out, when the individual on the ground is just looking at it as if it's a blur. So for us, that was what we tried to do. And it's funny, in the end of the thing, we actually found the structure of it actually turned out being a lot like a traditional textbook. So in a funny sense, we felt we sort of came back to this. We didn't intend it to be that way, but it sort of came out that way. We also tried to write it not as a traditional textbook, at least we tried to make it as engaging as we could. So hopefully it doesn't come across that. Again, as we said, widest list of topics was intentional: politics, health, international aid, development, Iraq war, terrorism. Topics were mean to an end, describe how tools of complexity could be deployed to achieve more sustainable public policy outcomes. A whole range of other policy areas were equally viable. We would argue, and we've argued in lots of sense, say, well, actually, complexity applies to any area. Any policy area, it's just a matter of, these were the ones we were interested, engaged in, and excited about. We would argue could have certainly picked a whole different range. We also kept them very big because we wanted to sort of look at, if you like, the big picture, whereas where we are both now is much more, okay, we felt like, for us personally, we sort of captured the big picture. Now the real question for us is, well, how do you take this big picture, start applying it down to a local level, local actor, how do you apply it down to organizations, public policy strategies? How do you get a local authority to start, if you like, applying complexity into thinking? How do you get a local education authority working on this? How do you get a local social services dealing with families in an impoverished area to coordinate on these strategies and to start building these in? Linked to that is, and we'll get to these questions as well, not only how do you do it, but how do you show that it works? The hopeful outcome was that readers would be engaged and excited by the potential of complexity, and since that's what we are, feel that it was commonsensical. This is, again, whenever we've given talks and we've done various sort of events, what have you, whenever you get local policy actors in, oftentimes we'll get a sense of, well, gee, this makes sense. But, I can understand this. Yeah, no problem. And they can see that it was relevant to their policy area, and hopefully, again, try to integrate some of the concepts or tools into those particular areas. So in a sense for us, although we focused the book in this very broad and major policy areas, we also believe it's equally applicable. It has, if you like, a fractal aspect to it that can apply to policy at any level that you find. As always, with any book, there's a hidden agenda. An age of discontent marked by a propensity for experts to find new ways to take the wrong decisions on too many occasions. Again, constantly confronted with difficult, complex problems, actors continually turn back to And I mean, in my own stuff, I tend to think the British in particular are this belief in somehow ordering the system will make it better. I often argue it in some sense, you have, particularly in the English context, where you have a strong, it's almost an authoritarian tradition, where policies will be allowed to drift away from targeting, auditing, control structures driven by Westminster. The minute something goes wrong with those, you know, a terrible thing happens, somebody gets shot, in social services, a social worker loses track of a child, the child dies, or somehow, and immediately the automatic jerkback position is right, more targets, more audit, lessons to be learned, greater control from the center will somehow solve and eliminate these problems for the future. I always love, for me, it was one of the first years I moved to the UK, where they had big snowstorms in London. And London, of course, you know, disaster. Everybody rushes out. It was rush hour. I think it was 1999 or 2000. I can't remember. Everybody rushes out to their activities. Immediately, traffic jams ensue. And they have to bring out some poor local, whoever was the head of the gritters, to say, OK, right, we've learned our lesson. We now know what we're going to do next time. It's all my fault. But thank goodness, lessons have been learned, and we won't have these again. And you're just sitting there thinking, well, even if he had 1,000 more gritter trucks, it wouldn't have made any difference, because at the minute the traffic jammed, you can't get the gritters out there anyway. So even if he put his hand up and said, well, really, we need 4 times the amount of gritters, well, it wouldn't do you any good anyway. So it was fascinating. They're very much with, and there's all sorts of things that we have, Sammy and I have lots of debates over this, in terms of that sense. Also, so this could never happen again. Fundamentally, it's an irritant rather than an assurance, because why are they saying this should never happen again? Basically, you know, fundamentally, life is becoming too complex for, if you like, standard linear structures. And in a small way, we hope to help, you know, we say this at the beginning, which when it's a grandiose claim, to hope to help the 21st century avoid some of the policy disasters of the 20th, because for me, and we use this in the beginning of the book, one of my favorite historic 20th century histories, Eric Hobsbawm, a book on, he called the 20th century the age of extremes, Nazism and colonial. And in a sense, for me, those extremes are founded on the belief that a final human order can be created. And once you have that order, the key is to force everybody into it. Because once you get everybody there, well, you're in the happy place, whether that's communism, neoliberalism, or what have you. And so the key is that, well, if you just force everybody in, well, the forcing of everybody in there tends to kill a lot of people on the way. For me, complexity isn't just another ism. It's a way of recognizing, well, actually, we don't know. There's an openness, there's structure, there's order, but at the same time, there's openness and a whole variety of possibilities. So in a way, you know, our hope is that we were trying to, if you like, stretch that a small bit. Questions for us, big picture, particular projects and questions, down to the local area and comparative directions. For us, big picture, change is the new old mantra. There's going to be more change in the forthcoming budgetary period. So how would you proceed to abandon or retain bits and pieces of the status quo sustainably? So in other words, we're in the current period we are. How do we pick the good bits and separate them out from the bad? What is the role of and rewards for elites? Social contract between rulers and citizens, core basic issues under a, if you like, a complexity vision. What of age-old norms, rules, regulations that, in a sense, establish these core elements for these large institutions? And there's lots of this. This is particularly Samir's website here, can't see it very well, globalcomplexity.org, where we Sammy has predominantly put up all sorts of different things that look at these bigger issues. Sorry, these are all small. This is the kind of stuff, and Sammy, we forgot to put his published bits up. This is the sort of stuff I've been working on just on different articles. I can talk to anybody about this. Mostly it's sort of, one is on EU health policy, another is on using visual metaphors for policy. EU governance stuff, complexity in IR, and some health stuff, European health stuff. So, big thing here, though, for me is, okay, you're starting to see growing academic work coming out, and lots of that goes, but a big question is, well, how do you move it into the mainstream? How do you move it so that actors outside of academia are willing to read a couple of pages, are willing to look at it, et cetera? So, you know, big question for ourselves and possibly for the group. Particular projects, we're hopefully working on a project on with Blackburn and Darwin Council on child and family policy, trying to have a strategy to build in a complexity framework for child and family policy. Liverpool, we're also working with Alison Holborn and Hope Street Center in terms of health policy, social organizations. University of Northumbria, woman Petia Slice, Sice, uses that for a regeneration strategy. And then we'll be looking at national policy linkages. This will be with Eve on our presentation that Eve and I are giving at the IPPR, of which Greg Fisher in the back has organized. So bits and pieces are rolling along, and there's all sorts of different stuff. You know, we can, if anybody has an interest, we can look at this. Key policy actor questions at this level. How does it help me? So for the policy actor, how does it help me to do more with less in a context of budget restraints? In other words, in the current context of clearly shrinking budgets, what does complexity do to help me deal with those shrinking budgets? Bang. How do I integrate complexity into my policy area when I'm surrounded, both above and below, targets coming down to me, local actors wanting me to adhere to those targets when it's in their interest, with orderly demands and structures? In other words, how do I, okay, I'm convinced, I think complexity is great, but if I'm going to get punished for it, how the heck do I deal with that? And then how can I prove it works? If anybody around me is critical of me, well, you know, if I'm going to get slammed for this silly thing, why on earth, how can I show the actors around me that it functions, that it helps, that it makes a difference? In essence, if you like using that term, you know, where's the evidence? And these are all sort of key questions. Again, for everybody here, it sounds like it's fairly integrated. These might be some interesting questions for us to discuss. Because in a way, it's about how does complexity move forward as a concept into actually answering some of these questions. And I like to take it, you know, for me, I take it immediately, try to take it down to a local level and sort of say, well, yeah, how do I convince a teacher that it's worthwhile to treat her students as complex adaptive actors rather than as targets and audits that she or he is literally, you know, given incentives to treat them as? You know, the more they're knocked up on the, you know, create the various linear graphs. If they're above the graph, the school gets extra points. If they're below, the school gets punished. How does a teacher, you know, in essence, recognize them as something other than targets? Current strategy or thinking for us, you know, as person, is find nurture, you know, sort of policy actor converts. I like to use that term, complexity converts. Work with them to teach complexity thinking, concepts, tools to policy actors in given policy area. Qualitative feedback from policy actors provides the evidence for utility and for revision. In other words, the idea is to say, well, okay, if you could get a group and say, right, in this area, we want to try to teach this. In this area, we want to try this families in this way. And literally, that creates interacting with those actors. So in other words, if they started working with it, you could then work with them. You would then be able to say, okay, what works? And actually start developing the qualitative evidence that would be able to say, well, we found this really useful, we didn't find it useful, that tool was clumsy and made a mistake, this tool was a disaster, this tool was really fantastic. In essence, our thinking was that, well, in a sense, that's your next step. And in time, we don't know, but in time, quantitative indicators of improved performance may improve and provide more evidence of usefulness. So in other words, you'd have to, at best, you would be looking for a qualitative relationship to emerge at which, over time, the unit or the policy area should improve, you know, given those things. But again, no guarantee, no promise there. But fundamentally, if you're able to work with it over time, you would hope to see those types of things that would provide more evidence and more learning. Comparative dimension, local, national, international level. We would argue that the fractal nature of complexity concept and tools, in other words, it's a self-similar process. The type of tools you're using at a local level for a teacher are applicable for an educational unit, for a strategic health authority, are then applicable to a national level policy area, And they're implicable at an international level as well. In other words, what you're seeing is self-similar processes. The counter-argument to that is, if you like, the self-similar structure that's been driving UK policy has been a fundamentally linear target audit-based strategy. And that's been reproduced, and it's fascinating, in education policy. You can see that it's linear use of XY graphs as targeting, you know, create an idealized target. You then apply the act, whether it's individual school students, teachers, schools, educational authorities, whole regions, the whole thing just works up like a, you know, through a, in essence, self-similar fractal process throughout the whole area. We would argue that the strategy would be, in essence, to try and use complexity tools as a way of, if you like, replacing that linear fractal organizing principle with complexity ones. Concept tools evidence are relevant from one policy area to another and from one level to another. And obviously, it doesn't just apply to the UK national and international comparisons. In fact, some of the most interesting places, things I would argue, or you know, I think we'd argue, Australia and Canada seem to be home of a number of very interesting complexity groups and academic activities. And I would argue that this is due to their federal structure. They're used to messier governmental policy structures. It's just normal for them. And so in terms of complexity, there never was this, or for them, there never was a belief that there was one center of power. There was never one point that was the final say, because you always had the federal state structures competing against each other, struggling against each other in one fashion. So I would argue they have a sort of a natural complexity tendency in them. In the UK, complexity is still, I would argue, particularly apt. And it's also quite radical. Radical in the sense of challenging the existing structures, not in a left-leaning sense, if you like. We wanted to just end here. We've got a whole bunch of other things that are linked to the book itself, tools, concepts that we could walk through. But fundamentally, we thought that would just be a lecture and you'd be too passive in sitting there. We're more than happy to talk through any of the tools and concepts or any of the issues we talked here, I've had my go, so I'll shift the microphone over to Sammy, and he can start answering all the questions.
Seems reasonable.
Excellent.
Okay.
Do you want me to turn this off, and we use that thing?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I think that will be better. Okay, because it would actually be rather nice if we could also cover the bit on complexity mapping, Stacey diagrams, foreign policy actors, and so on. The
okay. Do you want me to, do you want to start answering the questions, and
yeah.
I can hunt up some of the, if we move to
yeah.
those things, we've got the various
Great.
Things that we can pull up.
Excellent.
Sammy?
Yes, Eileen.
Why don't you stand up?
I worked in the Treasury in the 1970s and the 80s on public expenditure control in terms of managing the government service itself. And I was there at the beginning when cash limits first came in 1975. And then during the 1980s, under the Thatcher government, what happened, in my experience, was that a sort of bookkeeping idea got into the central processing. Which then cascaded through the whole of the public sector system, right through to the water sector, quandos, all the rest of it. It took about 10 to 15 years to wend its way through. Obviously, very much on the linear organizing principle. And that was how this extraordinary revolution in management, driven by extraordinarily stupid targets, which were the, an end in themselves, crazy targets. And that was when it started. That particular thing started in the 1980s and started taking implementation, really started cascading through from about 1984, 1985, right through all the different levels of the system. I was just thinking about, I was wondering if you had any thoughts about this, what happened before that? Because I got into this process in 1969, so I sort of watched it happen. It didn't seem to be so target-driven in the 1970s, but I could see that it was beginning to be there. Needed to get their fingers on how much money was being spent. But it was in the 1980s that it got so tied to linear processing through bookkeeping, basically. I mean, it was a bookkeeping revolution, talks about what happened before the 1980s and 1970s.
Well, I mentioned
that
enough
linear,
to... Yeah, he's old enough.
Whether that was still linear organising, or was there a shift? That's what I'm really quite
about. Actually, I mean, yes, I am old enough to have been working in the 1970s, and I don't think there was ever mention of shortage of funds. It sounds really quite crazy, right? And really, throughout that period, money was no object. And in fact, that was exactly the time when I was working on a land use transportation model for Merseyside, which cost us at that time, with a Canadian consulting company, £500,000. Money at that time, so you can imagine it must be worth a bit more now, which was immediately thrown aside, and we said, well, it doesn't work, forget it, let's do something else. That was nice, and we enjoyed it. May I just say something which may not sound very nice coming from, if you like, a foreigner, although I've been here many, many years. I think Britain has been exceedingly wealthy for so long that money does not mean anything, did not mean anything to Britain. We are only now living in this wonderful time when there is restriction on the amount of money, even in your, if I may call it your time, you know, when you were talking about the 80s and so on. It was really shadow boxing. You know, oh, we're short of money, let's do something, let's do a bit of bookkeeping, let's put a few limits on spending and so on. But really, we've never got to the point where we said, by the way, we don't have any money left. Now, the interesting thing that's happening at the time, at this time now, is that actually, not just Britain, by the way, Europe, the United States, and so on, are running out of money. And this is exceedingly wonderful. I know it sounds crazy, exceedingly wonderful, because it's only when you run out of money that you begin to do the right things. I have worked as a non-exec director in the NHS for 15 years. It coincided with the time when Labour came to power, New Labour, 1997. And they poured money into the NHS. The money didn't go into services, I'm sorry to say that, but it went into management, right? Into working parties, into working groups. And please don't mention this outside because I still work in the NHS, but the money was not directed towards services. You contrast that with what happened in Cuba. When the moment the American embargo came along, they said, by the way, we haven't got any money. So how do you keep people, not healthy, but reasonably looked after? Well, gee, I'll tell you what, the first thing we have to do is to go back to first principles and think, what does really help health? And there are only two or three things, by the way, that helped. One was the standard salary to all workers. A GP gets as much as a nurse, surprisingly enough, which I discovered that, much to my shock, coming from Britain. And you say, how could that happen? How do they put up with it? And then they came back. The problem with the NHS is that it's got too much money. And, you know, when you were talking about the 1970s, 1980s, we had lots and lots and lots of money. We were extending motorways, we were building, getting rid of railways, we were doing all sorts of things, because we had money. But at the moment, there is a quantum shift in life in the West, in the richer countries, I shouldn't say the West. And that is absolutely wonderful, because it's driving you right back to complexity work.
Okay, now can we then open up this question from a complexity perspective? Why is it wonderful? Because I think we need to understand, using complexity language, using complexity principles, why this is so important.
Because finally you get to doing the right things. You know, we speak about, for example, stakeholder engagement.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you speak in any complexity context, you speak up. Change happens at the local level. You've got to involve the people who are working at the coalface, at the front line, and so on. And we think of that as participation. And I have done many participation exercises where you decide what you want to do, and then you go out and you produce a nice brochure, and you say to people, well, what do you think of this? And they say, we love it. And we go back and we say, by the way, 13 people said they don't like it, but they are idiots. And the other 97 said they love it because, of course, we are clever. We wouldn't have gone to them with something as rubbish as that. Mm-hmm. Actually, when you look at complexity and when we're talking about stakeholder engagement, we're talking about actually bringing the frontline troops in to say to them, by the way, what problems should we be dealing with? We don't know. What should we be looking at? And by the way, we're quite broad-minded to think that these problems are going to change over time. And as we begin to solve problems, they're going to change in nature. This is a level of stakeholder engagement which none of us in Britain have even thought of doing. They do some of it in Australia, by the way, but we have never, ever considered actually... Forgive me.
Okay. Is it related to that? Because good.
Yes. I mean, I think the big challenge would be stakeholder engagement, and so I think complexity is potentially a hostage to fortune in the debate. As I mentioned, my background is predominantly white, and I moved to get private sector experience. My first day in the private sector was the day that Lehman Brothers crashed. And what I found quite startling is hearing public debate, whether they are captains of big industries through to the owners of small medium enterprises, right the way through to sessions on foreign policy and business relations with the BRIC countries. Well, government should do something. What's the government going to be doing? And those are the statements that have been coming out since the election, let alone since the economic crash. Mm-hmm. And even talking with friends at barbecues over the weekend, and they're saying, well, you know, it's all very well Cameron putting the statements in the press about no one understands quite how difficult it's going to be, and public sector cuts this, that, and the other. And I said, well, I know what public sector salaries look like and bonuses look like. I did 18-hour days during the Kosovo conflict. My bonus was £150. So it's not as if everybody's fat cats, but they're big, fat assumptions. Nobody feels it's their responsibility. And I think part of the risk for complexity, I think the C word is used a great deal. Mm-hmm. And I think the C word is used as a substitute for complicated, mm-hmm. which then becomes overcomplicated, and then falls into the all-too-difficult box. Mm. And I think the big challenge for complexity theory is actually to lend clarity mm-hmm. among complexity rather than making it seem more complicated than it need be. Yeah. I think also, taking up the complexity theory, going back to your question, education policy is very interesting. If you look, I think you have to take the Second World War as a benchmark, because then you had a national coming together of the nature that people are talking about. In the current, what's government going to do, and I'm an individual environment. And one of the phrases that have fallen out of the UK policy debate for a long time was the concept of national interest. The concept of national interest didn't begin to bubble through in the foundations of the health service. It was very much there in the foundations of education policy. Because education policy planning in the 1940s was very much around the hierarchical structure of you need a certain percentage of people who are going to be the captains of industry and the leaders, a certain proportion of people who are going to be the managers, and a certain proportion who are going to be on the factory line. And that was roughly how you had the university system established, where you had Oxbridge and Oxford. Now, there were certain those assumptions shifted significantly, particularly under the last major government and through what we've just seen with Labour, which is it's about access to education, irrespective of the purpose of education. And what I find very interesting talking to university professors at the moment is that by sort of exploding it, by making polytechnics into universities, for example, where you have the concept of applied versus theoretical, no one's quite sure where the boundaries lie. And if complexity can lend anything to policy planning at this juncture, I think it's precisely around the identification of and definition of the boundary. Mm-hmm. The last work that I did in Cabinet Office was an IT programme to get 10 government departments to share information nicely. And you wonder why government IT programmes don't always succeed. And my role was on the business change aspects of that, and I came to it having just done some work on complexity as a beneficiary of the year out, as it happens. That wasn't why I got the complexity understanding. understanding of how it sort of fits in was very, very limited. But was absolutely fundamental to me understanding the dynamics between these 10 very distinct, very passionate organisations, partly understanding where they might converge. And again, we haven't talked about convergence right yet, but convergence is coming up time and time again politically right now. As well as those areas where it was important not to converge. And I think you could apply absolute complexity model to negotiations, even at the minute, with forming the new coalition. And then what does that mean in convergence terms for how hierarchical institutions allow the white people to behave in delivering public policy? It might not spread my much, this is something else I'm writing at the minute, but I think there's something much more than just how does the theory help the teacher deliver in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more about what does the lack of money, absolute might, enable us to do through complexity by moving away from hierarchical boundaries towards a much more nuanced but inevitably more complex system and structure.
If I may just add one little bit to your clarity, I think clarity of roles in decision making, because I think you've hit the nail right on the head, that in fact it's once you adopt the complexity route, you are beginning to think in different decision makers than you had in the past.
Did you have any response?
Well, I guess what was interesting, the interesting thing is the way we were pitching a lot of the book, if you haven't seen look at it, was about, because we saw we were writing it through this period of the dominance of the audit targeting culture, a lot of it sounds like, oh, we're for automatically for more chaos. You know, in other words, what you need to do is break down these systems, make them all nice and flexible and this stuff. And the key for us, and then I was thinking we could pull up, if you're aware of the work of Ralph Stacey, and he has a sort of a Stacey diagram, which is absolutely fantastic. In other words, what we were trying to really get across is to say, well, no, what you've got on these systems, you know, whenever you're dealing with complex, with these problems, there's a range of elements. There's orderly elements to them, they're complex, and then they're highly chaotic. You have to be able to identify, well, what's the orderly bits that take normal, orderly, hierarchical structures and work? You know, they do all the time. Look at a hospital, and you can easily identify the broken bones, no problem, those go there, plaster, bang. You can do those, you can almost mechanize those things. It's where you get into chronic conditions that are linked to lifestyles and talking about community health. All of a sudden, you're into the really messy bits. And the implication there is very, to me, it may have come across in the book because, in essence, we were writing in this period where the driving force, I would argue, was linearity and order, and so we were often pushing against that. But the argument works exactly the same in the opposite direction. It isn't thus that you make a mess of things and somehow that makes it better. It merely tries to say, well, actually, the thing is to recognize you've got a spectrum here, and then desperately pushing it into the order box doesn't make it better. Desperately using tools and targeting and auditing doesn't automatically enhance it. It'll work in certain zones, in certain areas where there's agreement and where there's consensus and where the experts say, hey, look, we'll just apply these particular things. The minute you move away, and that's, we could pull it up here. I don't know how we want to, we could pull it up and sort of walk through it. But to me, that was, at least in the book, that was a worry that we had, but because we were operating in that period, as I think it was Dos Santos in your earlier book, Sammy's earlier book on development, said, well, the fundamental problem with the poor is property rights. You know, if you don't know that you're going to have your farm a week from now, bandits are going to take it, or the government might come in and stuff. In essence, you're in a funk. What do you need? You need order. You need the knowledge that you're going to have your farm in by the next growing season. Then you're able to plant, then you're able to harvest, then you're able to hold on to that. That's a system that doesn't need more mess. So I guess that was the only thing, that was a problem we were worried about in the book, because we were critiquing the British frame of reference. What we wanted to say, well, no, you have to recognize it as a spectrum. It just depends on which system, which policy, or which part you're looking at, and to encourage policy actors.
While you're pulling it up, I'd like to actually go back to this question of Cuba, because I think this is very, very important, because it's the same as what's happened recently under the financial crisis we've had, it's the same as what's been happening in terrorism, etc., etc. Because one of the beauties of complexity theory is that it can help us understand why. Why do these phenomena happen? if we can understand why, if we can actually identify the problem space, the multiple dimensions that make up the problem space, we can actually address it. Because there isn't a single solution, but there is a range of ways in which we can address a complex problem. One of the things we need to understand is the Farnsworth equilibrium idea, which is, you know, all systems are under certain boundary conditions, but there comes a point.
You don't have a black pen because it's impossible to read the.
I haven't got another pen. It's very odd, but like there seems to be only one on this table.
Okay.
I will ask Monica to bring another set when she comes back. The point is there comes a point when there is something that happens in the external environment, which means the system can no longer exist, continue under its existing regime. Something fundamental has to happen. That's what happened in Cuba. So what happened at that critical point? They explored the space of possibilities. They explored alternatives. That is why Sam is saying that we are in a fortunate position in being here, because it will force us to explore the space of possibilities. We have no choice. And when there is no choice, when we are forced to explore our space of possibilities, that is the greatest point of innovation. And then, of course, even though the theory calls it a bifurcation, which means a splitting into two, that's only looking at it in retrospect, because at this point there are multiple alternatives that are being explored, and we either create new order, create something new, or the system dies. And that is the explanation for what happened in Cuba. That is why, if we understand this in the financial sector, we cannot go back to the status quo. We cannot go backwards. We have to create a new order. We have to create something different, something new, which is appropriate to the new environment. And I think we need to understand this in order to go forward. So.
Well, can I just comment?
Yeah, a lot of comments. Great, that's fantastic.
You can go back to the original thing.
Yeah.
If the catastrophe doesn't happen. So lots of people will try to stop the change happening. And that's, I think, the danger in all of these things. The finance problems now. There are lots of people trying to ensure it does go back to how it was. And, you know, the challenge that Cameron and Kiko will have will be to convince people that there really is a catastrophe, which I think is what he's trying to do.
Yes. There are an awful lot more, Eileen, and I know this gentleman here had... Did you still have your question?
I just wanted to pick up from Louisa. Okay, Louisa James was saying this thing about government should do something. This seems to me to cut to the core of complexity in public policy, which is the role of the state, the role of local authority, the role of the, you know. And for me, the question is always, when that comes up, is who has agency? And the presumption is the government has agency, that the local authority has agency. I think that's a bad assumption. I think it's one that the state and the local authority themselves take far too much to heart, takes far too seriously, and it's wrong. It doesn't work. I think where we are, where we need to be, and I think they're maybe taking baby steps with that in terms of with the big society idea, is actually the citizen has agency and the state facilitates. So I think that's kind of what seems to be emerging, or where it needs to be going, from my perspective. Coming back to stakeholder engagement, I mean, the approach we're taking with the social startup labs is obviously one of our key targets are people who are long-term unemployed or possibly disadvantaged. And our approach is not to say, right, we're going to do this to you, because we can't. Our approach is to actually get them in the room, with a bunch of other people and facilitate a collaborative generative process where we can actually find out what the needs are in the room, what are the assets and resources available to actually try and address those needs, and see if by combining the two we can actually create opportunities. We have no idea what the outcome is going to be. We can't control it. We're not going to try to. We've got some ideas about how things could go and how it might turn out, but we're just creating the space for it to happen. Finally, coming back to what Eve was saying about this diagram, I mean, the way I sort of think of it is, I have a notion of the default future. You know, if things continue as they are, where do we wind up? And then also, besides the default futures, there's possible futures. Now, the thing is, most people take and assume the default future is going to be business as usual. It's definitely not for the need to actually do something or make any change or anything like that. It's when, in situations like the Cuba and possibly in situations we've got coming up now, that the default future looks nothing like business as usual. It looks like going off a cliff. That's when things start to mobilise and things start to happen.
Great. Okay. Now, I had a lot of hands up, so who still has questions? Yes. Yes.
Combining some of the points that were mentioned here, the big question that's in my mind is, where is the incentive for a government to actually take seriously the lessons of complexity when they have to get elected? To me, this idea of this change in the 80s, for me the change was 24-hour media, 24-hour news media. And what the Labour Party absorbed through the likes of Mandelson and, you know, the group of three that built the new Labour was that unless you control the media agenda, you're going to be out of power very quickly. So what they learned is, and what I think evolved, was a psychological contract between government and citizen. Mm-hmm. And the psychological contract was, put us in power, we'll tell you what plans we've got, and these plans are all going to work, and we're all going to be fabulously better off. Fortunately for the Labour Party, we went through global economic success like we've never seen. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with what the government was doing. It's just a pleasant coincidence. So what it did was reinforce this psychological contract where the citizen doesn't do anything. They mainly work 60 hours a week and go on holiday and worry about what car they're getting next. That's now their new job. The government basically doesn't allow the gravy train to stop. So it ends up pandering to the city because that's where the gravy train is coming from. So we've got a situation where governments feel they have to manage the media agenda, which means they have to continuously come up with, you know, initiatives and plans that we're going to do this. And when something blows up, you have a commission, they have a look, we're going to make sure this never happens again. We keep going round and round. We keep hearing these phrases. And to me, what's happened is that managerialism has been imported as an ideology that will get governments elected. Not as an ideology that will put things right, but as an ideology that will get parties, political parties, elected to government. Now, I agree with what everybody's saying in terms of we can all see what the problem is. The person on the street can see what the problem is. The trouble is nobody wants to swallow any of the lessons. The politicians and the government doesn't want to swallow the lessons, because then actually you really would have to create a big society. You would have to distribute power. You would have to say, actually, our job is to give you what you need in order to decide what you think your local problems are and give you sort of knowledge, information, infrastructure that allows you to have a deliberative discussion about how in your locale you're going to solve those problems and then share that with others, not with a focus on best practice, because with complexity, that doesn't make sense. That's a NAF concept, but to just share some experience. Now, the politicians don't want to do that because then they can't get elected. actually, the citizens don't want to do that because they're working 60-hour weeks. So we've got this impasse between, you know, up there, nobody's really incentivized, and I can't see that changing. Down here, I don't see that many people incentivized. You have got, you know, people baking bread and making local food and, you know, community-supported agriculture. These kinds of things are happening, but they're not having that much of that often.
Yeah.
I can't see where the incentive is for any significant movement other than complete chaos that then forces you to say, you can either keep going and getting it worse, or you can try something different.
Okay. Sammy actually has a response.
Well, actually, I mean, what you say is right in terms of, yeah, there might be a catastrophe that would force you into it. But we don't need to be that pessimistic about it. Change is slow. I mean, we're talking about certain changes which really, if they take place in the next 30 to 40 years, and I won't be here to tell, but you can tell me when we meet later. But, you know, I'll be delighted. Think about the third sector. How many of us had heard about the third sector only 20, 30 years ago? We have on our board in the Primary Care Trust official representatives of the third sector. We have two non-exec directors from the third sector sitting there, large as life. And they're making life very, very difficult for the officers and the politicians on the board. So I don't think we need to look at it in black and white, say, oh, Jesus, you know, unless there is a huge catastrophe, it'll not change. The situation is changing. The one good change, which is why I said this problems we're having now are wonderful. In my book, anyway, they're wonderful. Because at the end of the day, you will find politicians don't want to handle a lot of the issues that we are talking about. And if you listen to the politicians carefully these days, what are they saying? Send it to the local level.
Yes.
Send it to the local level. We don't want to know. And what does the local level do? I mean, they're talking at the moment about parents taking care of charge of schools. I was a parent. I'm a parent. I'm damned if I'm going to waste my time going to school and managing a school and so on. I've got enough to do in my own life. The third sector will step in, or the private sector for that matter. I don't care. But the third sector is getting bigger and bigger and bigger in Britain. And in that context, you don't have to look at it in terms of government and atomized individuals. You can think of it as government and third sector.
Can I just show my ignorance and ask what the third sector is?
Everything that's not government or commercial.
Yeah, voluntary organisations.
Charities and so on.
It's a new made up concept with a whole lot of things together, which actually are very dissimilar.
But it's very interesting that, you know, it's wonderful that you should say, what is it? Because it's such a new concept, and yet it's looms large in, certainly in my life, working either at the university or in the NHS.
Okay, Alexander, then Greg, then, yes, Neil.
I had the unfortunate experience of being part of the Futures of Iraq planning group.
Oh, really?
Actually, I was one of the international advisors or the observers.
You are at the 10,000 pages.
Yeah. On three of the 17 working groups on democratic principles and procedures, local governance, and civil society. For about 6 months from September until February, September 2002 to February 2003, then was in Kuwait in March of 2003 and entered Iraq and was there for 8 months from April until whenever.
Where were you in Iraq?
All over. And working on governance and elections.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. So I empathize with what you've been saying, and just having flipped through this, the dichotomy you draw between the Cheney Rumsfeld camp of authoritarian and linear, we're going to force this into this process, and versus the Colin Powell camp that was at least a little bit more.
Yeah.
Open and holistic approach. When I got into Baghdad in April of 2003, the first question was, where are our 10,000 pages? Because at least it was a basis that had some interconnection between the various 17 sectors.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. military liaison there said, actually, we threw that away because it didn't make any sense to us. This is the plan.
Mm-hmm.
So The slide you had there about how do we speak to people who've got order and linearity above and below them? Those three questions you put there. My question to you is, based upon that slide and those questions, have you identified any trends in the organizations that make policy, whether on the government or the intergovernmental level, where you get traction?
Mm-hmm.
Are there trends
mm-hmm.
where you get traction that someone is able to say, all right, I'll listen to you and consider
mm-hmm.
it? Is it because they have no other option and they're finally broken
mm-hmm.
That they're willing to consider that?
I think the beauty about what you described is that war, because you remember the fight between the Department of Defense and the State Department.
Yeah.
And the fight was over the difference between this bit of the Stacy diagram and that bit. War is a linear process. If you have a large enough, as Churchill said, overwhelming force, you win the war, damn it, that's it. End of story. We just land the troops, and within 6 hours or 6 days, they win the war. It's finished. That phase is over. The problem that actually happened is that the State Department did not then take over the peace section, which is the complexity bit. And therefore, you continued on the military thinking, which is 2 + 2 = 4, for God's sake. We've always known that. And it doesn't work. It breaks down. And in fact, it really is the best illustration of what we're trying to get at in the book. But in fact, it's not either all complex or all disorderly or all orderly. You've got to really know exactly which zone you are dealing with and adopt the right tools for that zone. And I think, to be fair to the American system, annoys me.
Yeah. Is that what you had in mind, though, Alexander?
No, you're asking different questions.
Yes.
When
you found someone who listened to you, why were they listening?
Yes.
Exactly.
Why was it?
It's easy. It's easy because they are military people. I mean, they are, the Eisenhowers of this world who can transform themselves from military thinking, linear, to presidential thinking, complex. Are far, it's very few. The rest are linear.
Yeah. Well, I would say, it's interesting, because that relates back to all the politics. I mean, fundamentally, that's this fundamental question. Well, it doesn't have to be the military issue. It can be a health issue. It can be what have you. This is the constant thing. I was giving a talk, strangely enough, to construction managers, and they said the amazing thing in this construction, we were just a general talking complexity, and they said, I agree with you completely. But my buyers want an exact date.
Yeah.
They're going to give me an exact date on this. And in fact, the workers that are under, that I'm sort of set up, I'm going to give them exact dates. They want exact mm-hmm. dates and when things are going to happen, when things are going to move around. And so how do I deal with that? I said, how do you deal with that? He says, I cheat. And I give them an exact date, but I build in enough time that I know I'm going to be able to make it.
Yeah.
So in other words, if I say the building's going to be ready on June, I think it's going to be ready in March. But I'll give myself 3 months to play with in case it's new. If workers are, and so in other words, he was trying to manage what was fundamentally this complex adaptive, because he's got different buyers coming in, he's dealing with these different situations, but he's being demanded. So he has to cheat on rigidity. And if you think about all the other actors, this is when it's back with the local policy actors. They're always cheating on rigidities too. They've got a student, they've got a patient who's this thing, a little messy. Okay. Well, we'll say he's in today, and I'll cover up for him in some fashion. Or, the student's getting such and such. And it's funny, you whenever you're dealing with them, they know this tension's there. They get good at cheating on it. As I had a very good friend of mine who was talking about targets in the NHS. And we were having a beer, and we were trying to guess, can you make a target that I can't cheat on? And so I guessed, death rates in surgical units. Because patient dies, lives or dies. Bang, that would be a solid answer. And he said to me, if finance, if money was tied to that, and that was an important indicator, in a night, I could change my surgical units. They'd all skyrocket in terms of their, you know, their death rates that would occur. I said, well, how would you do that? I just tell them, don't pick the sick, don't operate on the sick. You know, only operate on the healthy ones. You know, the elderly patient comes in, you just forget them, and all their things would go up. The key there is, in essence, you're absolutely right. And what does a government do that a society is demanding, give us targets, and we'll reward you because we'll re-elect you? 20 left, 4 minute, you know, 4 hour waiting list creates all sorts of problems for the hospitals because they've got to throw all these resources into A&E that they can easily use more effectively somewhere else. May the rent, he stood by it, bang, he gets re-elected. You're absolutely right. My sense is there, you know, in a sense it's the revolutionary, you know, where, how do you start the revolution? You know, fundamentally, I haven't found, you know, I certainly many times haven't found the quickie answer to that. In essence, what you're doing is reshaping an entire cultural interpretation.
Actually, I think in my experience, that's the benefit that projected science gives you.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
It breaks the spell before complete disaster.
Yes.
So people who aren't exposed to it think, well, I know why it doesn't work, because it was never going to work in the first place.
That's right.
So I need to stop looking somewhere else.
Yes.
Right.
And decide,
yes,
how do I change the way I live my life now,
right,
so that I can build resilience into it.
Absolutely.
I think
resilience and flexibility are at the heart, because what you call cheating, I would call,
sustainability.
Sustainability, but also flexible response.
Yeah.
But in order to do that, you have to understand coevolutionary dynamics. If you don't understand coevolutionary dynamics, you're not going to get anywhere, because you know that you're going to adapt, you're going to change the way you're doing things, but hold on, you're not in isolation. Everyone who's affected by your change in behavior, your change in decisions, your change in action, are going to respond in return. So the whole thing is beginning to change.
Yeah.
The whole landscape is deforming.
And I was just going to say, back to the point about, if you like, the negative thing, I was thinking, really, there's been a bonfire of targets now for the last couple of years. Targeting culture is starting to fade. And I'd argue, before all the money crises hit, the teachers have been revolting on that. I mean, now that you have more than half the head teachers refusing the whole thing, I mean, you really are seeing, I was saying, right, this is, and the government's not bashing down on them. Actually, I actually think the targeting audit phase is actually starting to fade. That doesn't mean that over a period of time it'll then come back. I'd argue what you've got is, if you like, you've got a pendulum going between all of a sudden you hit sort of an orderly phase. Right, what we need is more order and more targets. We've got these fancy new computers and they're going to tell us these great things. That, you can also track that back. You mentioned earlier about the other things. It immediately reminded me of the Soviet Union. That the hope was in the Soviet Union that all their planning problems were going to be solved by the computer revolution. This was in the 60s, 70s. Russian economists were all arguing over, well, bring these computers in because, boy, they're going to solve our planning problems. And so, you know, if that belief in that if we just had a little more data, if we just had a little more order, now I would argue we'll then go through this downward phase, and then you'll have a return to that centralizing tendency with whichever new technological innovation comes along, it'll be linked to that. I would argue complexity has the potential to move the society away from those radicals. It doesn't mean it stops exploring the potentialities. But it has a chance to move it away from, if you like, the really radical swings that UK policy is evidence of this, that really go shooting off to, boy, we're going to make these targets work this time.
Okay. I'm finding what's really influencing me is the fact that I have an 18-year-old daughter.
Do what, sorry?
I have an 18-year-old daughter. And what I can sense myself thinking in the back of my head is, you know, whatever psychological contract I may have had with the government and the world of politics and how the country gets run. Even if all that's broken down, I can probably just keep ticking along.
Okay.
But my daughter can't.
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay.
The world she's going into can't work like that, so something has to change.
Mm.
If I can pick up on that point.
Okay, because I was going to say the tea has been waiting there for half an hour. and so, Neil, very quickly, and then we'll go on, because I still have Greg's question and so on. Yeah.
Made about
okay.
The devil's pact made between New Labour and 24-hour media. I think the next one is not going to be 24-hour media, because there are so many journalists out there now who are 18 years old. There are so many goal of government is to near enough eradicate itself and make itself smaller.
Okay, that's awesome.
Yes, can I suggest we just break for about 15 minutes, come back at 22,
and
carry on with our
discussion.
Fine. Thank you.
Sure. Questions back. That's pretty sad.
Yes, and we better decide what we want to do for the next half.
Well, I thought.